All right. Well, welcome to this OPIS Conference Committee, the Senate and House Transportation Conference Committee. Appreciate your indulgence and patience as we work through the schedules that we're all under right now. But we are excited to keep this process moving and very excited, actually, as we look at our agenda. What we're going to start off with today is a presentation and submission of language with the railroads in regards to a couple of items. One is certainly safety. The other is, they're both safety in regards to some of the day-to-day safety issues. The other is rail grade crossings and possible funding mechanisms for that and how we're going to move forward in that regard. So before we start, I want to absolutely thank all the people involved in this process. This is something that has certainly been on a lot of people's minds over the last couple of years, and what we have both Senator Dibble and myself have suggested to groups is what we have seen when we work together, when we sit down at the table across from each other and talk about our differences and how we're going to get there. That's what has happened over the last 2 years. This, as you'll see, will be the culmination of a lot of people's hard work and a lot of people's willingness to look at the issue as serious as we need to as a state. So with that, I will ask the representatives from the railroad to come up to the testifying stand and walk through some of our language. Senator Dibble, Mr. Chair, did you have any comments as we start?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. None other than thank you to everyone for your patience. I thought we were clipping through those bills pretty quickly, and then one of your former members had some detailed questions and amendments, and so we got a little slowed down. And I was also involved in several of the bills and had to be present in case they started getting a little too rough, so I had to stay put. And now that we're across the street from each other, it's hard to jump around. So thank you for your patience, and I look forward to today's conversation.
Great. And what we'll be working off of is the MB 181 language, if you have copies of that. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Appitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly & Kramer, and I'm representing the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association here today. In the interest of time and going through this, we'll try to be fairly quick. We do understand that Chairman Dibble does have to face the Rules Committee shortly, so he's got a big bill over there.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
So for members who don't know, we need to run over and pop Real ID out of rules because it's a late bill, Real ID Bill number 2. But the plan is that I'll just run over there and try to take care of that. Hopefully quickly, we'll see. But have the Conference Committee just continue on in my absence.
Thank you.
Please
continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We want to thank you for this opportunity and for taking the time to work with us through this whole process. We've traveled quite a distance since reaching the document that's in front of you, the conclusion of a lot of conversations about rail safety, and a lot of in-looking and a lot of conversation amongst ourselves, with yourselves, members of this committee, staff, et cetera. I want to thank Mr. Biros as well for his hard work and trying to pull all these thoughts together. It's not an easy sort of thing to do. There has been quite a bit since about the end of 1913, quite a bit of discussion about rail safety and concern and public concern related to rail safety. There have been several bills that have been introduced that we've talked about. There have been a number of provisions introduced and passed into law, many of which you see in the document that you got today. What we're doing is working off the statutes that were passed 2 years ago and trying to enhance upon those. I think over in the Senate we had a conversation about a month ago wherein we indicated, Mr. Sweeney and I indicated to the I think it was the Environment Committee or the Transportation Committee, one of the two, that we were going to be meeting with a group of first responders, representatives of the First Responder and the Emergency Managers Association, talk about concerns they had with the original statute and ways that it might be improved and enhanced. The language that was brought forward from those groups was encapsulated in some language that Senator Jensen and Representative Hornstein brought forward, and we worked with that document as the basis for the conversation. We had a couple of really good meetings, I think, since we've last seen you all and since we last had a conversation about that. And I'm going to let them speak for themselves, but we had a little sidebar here in which they indicated that we may have captured the essence of what they're trying to achieve, and that is gathering information that railroads have and that railroads can provide to better understand how to plan for emergencies should they arise. And one of the things I think we missed the first time around when we were doing this is we think of response to emergencies as kind of the obvious sort of thing that you do. Emergency managers, as we have learned, do a lot of planning to prepare for that response when an incident arises. None of us want an incident, but their job is to figure out how to respond to it should one arise. And so one of the things we missed in the original bills was inclusion of them and emergency managers and providing them with the information that they need, that railroads have, that help them do their jobs better. And so a lot of that's been encapsulated in the bill that you have before you, which I think Mr. Sweeney can go through with Mr. Burris' help because they were the two that actually put them together. The second part of this bill involves conversation about oil routes. You'll recall that the governor brought forward a bill that certainly caught our attention, or a proposal that caught the railroads' attention a couple of years ago, when he suggested that railroads pay the entire cost of improving grade crossings on railroad tracks along oil routes running through from North Dakota through Minnesota and out of the state. That was dramatic because typically grade crossings are public conveniences for the public roadway, and the railroads really don't get much benefit out of it. As a matter of fact, they create a great deal of liability, and we try to avoid that as much as possible. Given that fact, the Federal Railroad and the Federal Highway Administrations have determined that when a grade crossing is put in, the railroad's responsibility for that construction is about 5%. We maintain it once it's in place, but the construction of it costs about 5%. So when we saw a $300 million price tag for 100% of the improvements of grade crossings throughout Minnesota, we reacted with a little bit of panic and a little bit of concern, as I'm sure some of you can understand. What we did was begin a conversation with various members of this committee, and particularly with Chairman Kelly, and we do appreciate your time, Chairman Kelly, in helping us put together a way to address some of the priority crossings that invest the railroads more heavily than that 5%, that usual 5%, and which then, in turn, we think help them get those projects done. The governor, as you're aware, has included three priority grade crossings in his bonding recommendations. They are included now in the Senate's bonding bill. There are a crossing in Moorhead, a crossing in Coon Rapids, and a crossing outside of Red Wing on Sturgeon Lane, which is located entering the Prairie Island Reservation and Casino out there, as well as the nuclear power plant. And the railroads plan to step forward and assist beyond what they typically will do, beyond the 5%, and bring forward a contribution which we think will help move those projects forward. It's not the 100% the governor was looking for. That's a precedent that we would hope never to establish, but we believe it's a contribution of consequence to that particular effort. We can go through more of the details, but I just want to set up what the bill looks like so you understand what's involved here. And then I think there's some other testimony after we're done from first responders and emergency management personnel.
I'm Brian Sweeney with BNSF Railway Company in St. Paul. I'll go over the provisions of the language in front of you. The first part deals with oil response, oil and other hazardous substances, transportation data. What we're trying to do is address the problem that became apparent in the hearings of the bills introduced by Representative Hornstein and Senator Jensen dealing with first responders and access to information. There's information we do want them to have, the plans that we are required now to file with MPCA. We all know the problem that arose when a redacted plan was given to the emergency response planners. and the concern that there is information they needed that wasn't getting to them because of security considerations or concerns. So what this amendment does in a nutshell is require us to provide those plans to them and also guarantees that that plan is considered non-public data under Minnesota statute, and so that they have the information and the security concerns are addressed. It requires us to expand the training, the existing training requirement of providing oil training or hazmat training to fire departments that have jurisdiction along our line, expand that to make sure that the emergency managers are included in that training requirement as well. We're required to give the prevention and response plans required under 115E to the emergency planners and chiefs on request. Require us to share information that we have with, we are required by federal regulation to do a routing analysis for hazardous materials, 27 factors. There's a desire on their part to have the information that we use in making that calculation. So this would require us on request to provide that information used for the calculation to them as well. It would also require us to meet with the emergency planners and fire chiefs upon request. If they request a meeting within 30 days, we have to meet with them to review our response plan, what our capabilities are, who the people we have in place, their contact information, what equipment we have at our disposal, and the resources that we would bring to bear in the case of an emergency. Also, that we would give them, on request, an annual report showing all the hazardous material that has flowed through their jurisdiction, the type of material and the volumes, so that they have that information at their disposal for planning. With real-time information, there's a provision in this in what is called the FAST Act that passed Congress last year, requiring the railroads to develop real-time information systems on hazardous material shipments and to enter into memoranda of understanding with the state fusion centers to provide that real-time information to them. The provision in the bill would require the fusion center to take part in that program and to receive and disseminate that information in accordance with the federal statute. Another requirement that the information that is shared in these meetings that we have and the Fusion Center, that that information is also protected and made non-public for security purposes. This draws on a lot of the provisions that were in the bill that was introduced originally, rewrite some of them in a manner so that it comports more with the existing statute. We understand that there's some concerns with the first responder community, a few tweaks that we would have to make in the language. But I think in general, we are trying to address the concerns that we've heard expressed both in the legislature and in the meetings that we had with them that deal with their concerns about access to information and preparedness for planning, preparedness for responding to emergencies. With regard to the overpass proposal, what's contemplated, as Mr. Appett said, typically the rule of thumb is railroads pay 5% of the cost of the bridge structure that's involved in an overpass project. What we're proposing is that CP Rail, which has the crossing project in Prairie Island, and BNSF Railway, which has the other two projects on the governor's bonding bill, would participate at the regular or normal or regular or higher rate locally with the projects, the 5% of the bridge in the case of the Red Wing project, higher levels at BNSF with the Moorhead project. Our typical share would be something like $1.7 million. We've already committed to another $1.5 million to that project for some track work. Then at Coon Rapids, Hanson Boulevard, there we would participate at 5% of the total project cost rather than just 5% of the bridge. Then in addition to that, the railroads would make contributions to the state's Great Crossing Safety Fund, additional payments in the case of CP, $650,000, going toward their project, to be used toward their project. That would bring them up to 5% of the total project. In the case of BNSF, we would also donate another 5% of the cost for the Moorhead project and another 5% of the cost for the Hanson Boulevard project. Somewhere I've got those dollar amounts, but at Moorhead, we would be donating another $2,538,000, and then in Coon Rapids, our additional contribution would be $1,260,000. That we would be making that donation twice, so we would be into that project for a total of 10%. This is in keeping with precedent in other states, notably California, where funding is made available if the railroads are willing to participate at a higher level on a voluntary basis, and this would comport with that. And then in return, we would be looking for some assurance that the other tax proposals that have been made would not pass for the at least the next couple of years.
Mr. Chairman, could I add just one other item that I think is consequential? In both the Jensen and Hornstein bills was a provision that there be additional rail inspectors added to the Department of Transportation's contingent. Currently, the rail industry covers the cost of 4 inspectors. The request was for 5. The resolution that's included in this bill or this language would be 2 additional inspectors, which is consistent with the language in the House file as it's resting in the Ways and Means Committee right now. So it would be a total of 6 rail inspectors. We learned that this is of consequence as well to first responders and emergency managers, who often see these folks as their first line of defense or their first line of prevention, so we say. Also, I just might add some slight revisions, changes were made that are consistent with the Jensen Hornstein bill, which put some additional money into the MPCA that you'll find in the language under excuse me, item, I believe, excuse me, it's under section 6, which is on page 7. There are additional training activities that will go on for emergency managers and first responders. There will be tabletop exercises. There will be a regular, every third year, a regular field exercise, not unlike the one that was conducted here about 3-4 months ago. That was very successful up at Fort Ripley, and I think additional ones are anticipated for the future. Additional money is shifted from that account over to the PCA. Just for a quick bit of background, a couple of years ago when this statute was put into place, both the railroads and the pipelines were expected to contribute $1.5 million a year to a training and emergency preparedness fund that is held over a special fund over the Department of Public Safety. Of those proceeds, certain amounts are used for reports, certain amounts are used for personnel and training, and other amounts are going to be used for other purposes in the future. There's a report that I think was brought to all of you with regard to that. So those are just a couple of other items that Mr. Sweeney didn't mention. So we've tried to listen to all the voices as best we could and respond as best we could. And at the same time, you spent a lot of time with us before session started listening to the sorts of things that the rail industry has undertaken to try to make what we do safer and more efficient. And we've all learned some lessons out of this about the need for that, the concern of the public when they think it isn't that way, and what we need to do to make sure that it is that way going forward.
Thank you very much for your testimony. So the public does know we will make these documents online available online as well. And thank you, Mr. Apps, Mr. Sweeney. I also should recognize Senator Jensen and Representative Hornstein, who has done fantastic work on this. And again, want to thank you for your abilities to sit down and walk through this, where it's has been at time contentious, but I think we certainly all understand that we're all here in Minnesota working together and wanting to certainly keep everything safe and to keep business running. At this time, are there questions? We will have some other people who would like to testify on this as well, but we'll take questions at this time. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, we have in front of us, it's called Railroad Overpass Settlement. And there's language in here that's in the first person, and I'm not clear who this is from, so it'd be helpful to know who I is.
Mr. Appert?
This was a... Authorship? I'll claim authorship, sure. This was a statement we put together to share with the committee.
Thank you.
Senator Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking through the language, I am curious about how we are going to deal with some of the fiscal impacts that are in here. They're different than the original bill, and I'm not even sure where the grade separation projects cost sharing section came from, because that was not part of the original bill, so that part is completely new. So I'm not sure how that would work. If somebody can let me know how the fiscal note impact part of this would work. Because we don't have a fiscal note on MB 181, I don't believe. Okay. But we do have one on the original bill that went into the supplemental finance bill.
Okay. Senator Jessen, I can start with that one. Is the reason that that language is different, from the standpoint of how those would be funded or the contributions would come in. There's a number of items we were trying to, again, make sure that is agreeable to both sides. One major issue with any time we're asking for additional funding from the railroad specifically is that the idea of precedent setting and what is expected federally versus what we're going above and beyond doing. So some of that language was there because of working together with the groups to account for that and to allow for that. So I can let either Mr. Burris or Mr. Appert speak to that, but that's just part of the question as far as language. That's why it's different. But the other part of a fiscal note, I would have to defer and see where we're at with that, Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Lee and I had conferred a bit on this, and you know, there currently isn't a fiscal note for the MB 181. You know, depending on where the committee is headed, you know, a fiscal note could certainly be unofficially requested for this language. There are some differences in the provisions between this and the kind of Senate file or Senate position in this same territory, as well as differences between this and House file 3698. So, you know, the cost structure I would anticipate would be a bit different. For one thing, there isn't a financial responsibility requirement that would be put on the railroads that's part of Senate language. So that would presumably reduce some of the costs. I think it's fair probably to consider the additional allocation from the railroad and pipeline safety account to PCA as kind of a placeholder increase, depending on what kind of costs they would anticipate for the additional tabletop and exercise activities that they would undertake. And then with respect to the grade separation, the bill draft is silent as to where the state's funding would come from. Obviously, these are projects that have been discussed in the context of bonding, so general obligation bonds would be a possible funding source, and you know, this conference committee's transportation finance package could also address that. So that piece of it, I guess, is still a question mark.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So that's a concern of mine. Then if the railroads could talk to the provisions that were left out, which sections were left out, I would think we would need a list of what that is.
Mr. Chair, Senator
Sweeney.
What we left out primarily were one provision dealing with releasing bridge reports, bridge inspection reports. That's already addressed under the FAST Act, which was approved by Congress last December, where there's a provision in that requiring the Department of Transportation to set up a system to provide public versions of bridge inspection reports to requesting agencies. Also, the railroads have already set up through their websites information on bridges where anybody, bridge inspectors or average citizens, can request information regarding the safety. They could report concerns about a bridge. They can upload pictures and get a response from the railroad. So that's been addressed in a couple of different ways, one unofficial, but one official through the federal government. Another provision that was left out was the insurance provision from the original bill. Again, that is a federal government issue. It's FAST Act calls for USDOT to do a study on the insurance requirements, and also the financial viability and so on is subject matter for the Surface Transportation Board. So that was just beyond the reach of this of the state. So we, since that's been addressed on the federal level, along with the bridges, we left that out as well.
There was a third element, which provision, which required the railroads to provide technical information or provide data through a website for first responders to be able to use. And this was because the app that we've discovered this, the app that the Class I railroads have developed, which allows first responders access to information about train consists and what's in a car should an incident arise. Is something that isn't, the app isn't carried by a lot of first responders. And I'll let them speak to this more clearly for their own sake. But they do have access to it through a portable computer, for instance, in a fire truck. And they need that in another format. That format is currently being put together. Anticipate that that format will be provided, we thought, the end of this year or the middle of next year.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you. Just two other questions, if I could.
Absolutely.
So, if I'm hearing you right, so these provisions are already required for the federal, and so you feel that the state has no obligation or indication that they should participate, but it was the Senate's position that the state should be doing that, whether the federal is doing it or not, that the state should be making sure that we have all of these kinds of provisions in place. My question is there anything when it comes to the responders and the emergency planners that's in this legislation that you could not do without this legislation?
Mr. Sweeney?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there's information we could provide, but the problem is the security of the information. Some of it is very security sensitive, and so we need the provisions in this bill to protect that information when we do give it to them, so that we don't have a situation where, you know, somebody gets a redacted plan that's perhaps missing information that they need for their planning.
And is that is in the original language?
Mr. Swins.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not sure that that those protections were in there.
Okay. I'd like to hear from the other testifiers, and then I might have a few other questions.
Sounds great. Senator Schmidt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry if I missed it, but I'd just like a little more information on the proposed share on page 9 here for the grade separation projects. I know we have projects in Red Wing, Moorhead, and Anoka County that are identified here. I think the projects are, you know, very considerably in the expense, but I know the first project is only $250,000 with a proposed contribution. Can you say a little bit more about how you arrived at those numbers and anything more we could consider?
Mr. Senator, that's a CP project, so I'm kind of limited to what I can say for that, but their normal 5% share of the bridge structure cost was estimated at $250,000. And so they would pay that same 5% locally, but then they would make an additional payment that would bring them up to being the equivalent of 5% of the entire project.
The amount of which is rough, Mr. Chairman, excuse me, the amount of which Travis. Is about $900,000. So CP will contribute to the project and then to the crossing fund the amount of $900,000.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, could I add one other thing that we just forgot?
Ms. Travis.
When we were talking about things that aren't in this particular draft. And we were advised by the Department of Public Safety on how we might work with this. And I'm not going to go into a long dissertation on data practices. Some of you around the table know about this. But when certain information is provided to state government in Minnesota by Chapter 13's requirements, it becomes public information. Some of the information that needs to be provided that emergency managers and first responders want is what we call under federal law security-sensitive information. In other words, the type of information that isn't generally distributed to the public. It's distributed to those who have a need to know. Under the original bill, before we got to this point, information would that railroads were required to provide was going to be provided to the Department of Transportation, which essentially made it public information available to the public, and in fact, under the original bill, would have to be put on a website, as I'm recalling it now. That would definitely make it public information, and not the sort of thing that I don't think anybody wants to make public. Some people might, but we certainly don't want to see made public. The advice we received from DPS is one of the is that information which is required by federal government to be made available and which is considered non-public is under state law, Chapter 13, also non-public if that same information is provided to any particular state agency. So we took out giving it to the Department of Transportation and had it distributed to what are called fusion centers, which are essentially the centers that receive security-sensitive information and other sorts of emergency type of planning information. That way it's kept secure, it's not distributed through a website publicly, and it's distributed to the proper agency, both under the new federal FAST Act and under federal law, to the state emergency responders, state first responders and emergency managers. If that was confusing, I'm going to have you ask the DPS folks to explain it to you. I'm not sure I've got it all down just yet.
All right, thank you. Mr. Burris, a couple comments.
Mr. Chair and members, to the data practices questions, the bill as it was originally introduced had a mixture of elements of information that railroads had to provide being classified as non-public data. So the first two sections that you see in the bill draft, along with some of the data classification as non-public later in this MB 181, is reflective of the bills as originally introduced. And then there were some provisions that were specifically public. So, for example, the requirement of the Department of Transportation to provide information on the railroad track inspection program on its website, kind of summary information around the inspection results, was public, along with bridge inspection reports. And there's a publicly distributed community notification that was proposed in the original bill draft that would provide a fair amount of information that the railroads would convey as to routes and materials being transported. So there was kind of a mixture of some non-public data that was largely targeted towards, largely targeted as information being provided to emergency managers and emergency planners and fire chiefs, and then some components of public data that was intended for general, you know, public awareness and consumption.
Thank you. Any other questions for members at this time? Thank you for your testimony. And I believe we have representatives from the emergency response. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Sherry Munyon, and I represent the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers and the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. And I want to begin by saying, indeed, we're pleased with the direction this language has taken in working with the railroads. We've spent several hours having conversations about what was required for public safety personnel in terms of looking at prevention and also planning and then, of course, responding. I want to begin with a quick caveat that the Senate bill is a very comprehensive bill and dealt with many pieces that aren't the initiative of the emergency managers and the fire chief, so we've only been negotiating on these strict provisions relative to the public safety. We have not had final conclusion on language, but as I said, we are close. There's some additional wordsmithing, there's some additional language in Senator Jensen's bill that we'd like to incorporate in these pieces. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Eric Waggy. He is representing the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, and to my fire chief, Piper, who is going to speak for the fire chief.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Eric Waggy. I'm the immediate past president of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers. AMEM is an organization of city and county emergency management professionals statewide. So together with the Fire Chiefs Association, we've been working with you in the legislature since 2014 to try to ensure that detailed community planning information is available and usable by local emergency management and emergency response personnel. And so I'm happy to come here and report that we have reason to be encouraged and hopeful, and we've made recent significant progress working together with the railroad industry to try to address our concerns. We met this past Monday, and railroads of all different sizes and types were represented at the meeting, along with personnel from the state agencies that are interested in this issue, as well as emergency managers, fire service personnel, and some law enforcement personnel as well. Of course, our conversations were restricted to those things appropriate to the emergency response elements of these bills that we were looking at, but we've made progress and we've reached understanding. And so the proposed amendment that has come forward from the railroads, we received after our meeting on Monday. We haven't had a long time to take a look at it, but we have been able to identify some items that will require some tweaking, some terminology, clarification, some technical aspects, some other things like that. But we are quite close. So we're closing in on where we think we need to be. For this emergency response elements, we are excited about getting complete and accurate and unredacted planning information, time critical response information with this Ask Rail app, and if they make the changes that the fire service is requesting, we think that'll be a very usable product. We are aware of the security sensitive nature of a lot of this information, and so we think the safeguards that we're working towards are appropriate to meet both of our needs. We need some of that security protections as well for what we're working on. The training and exercise provisions, we want to integrate so that we're working together side by side with the rail folks, law enforcement, fire, emergency management, and even the pollution response personnel. And we also are very interested in the incident prevention aspects of having more inspectors, so we support that. So we're very close. We want to thank the railroads for their sincere efforts that they've shown toward us recently, and especially thank Senators Jensen and Representative Hornstein for their work on both houses here, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee for all your ongoing interest and attention to this issue.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, John Piper, Coon Rapids Fire Chief, representing Minnesota Fire Service. As you've heard, we've made a lot of progress, and we appreciate the railroads coming to the table and working with us. I have just three quick comments. One thing that we need to tweak, I think, is the training aspect of it. I've talked to Mr. Sweeney a little bit about it earlier today, but I think it's very important from a public safety standpoint that the fire service, law enforcement, emergency managers, and the railroad actually conduct some training, joint training, where we're all working together so we all know each other's capabilities. So I think we need to work a little bit on that. The Ask Rail, you've already heard that needs to be web-based. That's very important. So we can access the information from our truck computers. Again, that information is what's in the cars. That's not the planning information or anything like that. But that's the Ask Rail component. And then last, we do support the two rail inspectors that's been proposed by the railroad. My last comment is related to the grade separation. As Fire Chief in Coon Rapids, I can tell you firsthand that for the state and the rail and locals to work together to fund these grade separations is a big deal. I could go on and on, but I won't in the interest of time. But right now, this grade separation would be a big deal from a public safety standpoint, from an emergency response standpoint, and the driving public. It's going to be a tremendous help to Coon Rapids, so we hope everybody can work together on that. So that concludes my comments.
Thank you very much. Any questions from members?
Representative Hornstein.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just, I'm not on the committee, but since this is a bill that I helped author with Senator Jensen, I just wanted to make a couple of quick comments. And first of all, Mr. Chair, thank you for your efforts. I know you've been very engaged in this, and I think we're making a lot of progress in part because of your efforts, which are really appreciated. And I feel that the maintaining these inspectors is very important, so I appreciate that that seems to be moving forward. And I will trust the first responders to make sure that their interests are met. But I did want to comment briefly about the bridge inspection and insurance provisions that are in the Senate bill. I think those are really important to keep. And we also have some language in the House bill about route analysis and transparency on that, which I think is also important. So, you know, as the committee sorts through this proposal and looks at some other proposals, I'd encourage you to you know, maintain that language. And then finally, Mr. Chairman, you know, with regard to the grade crossings, and I think there was some confusion about that, and it seems like it's been rolled into some of the other legislation that we've had. I think what I, and this is the first I've seen of this just in the last few hours, but it seems to me that what's the proposal on the table is kind of matches a guideline that I think we've had in place around 5%, that the railroads would contribute 5%. So I don't think this is anything new, and I would encourage the committee to maybe look at, while 100%, you know, may be a lot, you know, maybe there's a meeting place that's somewhere between 5% and 100% that the railroads could chip in for these. So those are just my comments, Mr. Chair, and again, appreciate your work, appreciate the work of the committee, and Chairman Dibble, of course, and Senator Jensen as well. So thank you. And Mr. Chair, I imagine as the committee winds up its deliberations, whenever that is, you'll be, you know, looking at this proposal and getting more input, or what's the procedural plan at this point? You've got this idea on the table. I think the first responders want to tweak it. We have some other ideas. So where do we go from here?
Well, thank you, Representative Hornstein. The path would be to, or the goal would be to roll this language into our final bill here. And I want to thank you for your inquiry into the dollar amounts, because I think there is some confusion just in the way that is, maybe the way the language is, because at first glance, and I'll use the one at Sturgeon Lake as an example, it shows a $250,000 contribution in, because that's 5% of the bridge cost, which is what has happened. However, in addition to that, CP has suggested that they would put in an additional $650,000 into that other fund that would be used for those railroads. So actually three times the amount that under federal law that's what they're required to do. So it's a significant move, and that's where we were. I personally was very excited to see that amount and them to step up in that fashion. That's the same with the other projects. So it's significantly different than the 5% that we're used to.
So thanks, Mr. Chair. That's helpful. So maybe, you know, if there's a spreadsheet or something that could be prepared that shows what above the 5% is being contributed, and whether it's one time or ongoing, you know, these are questions that, you know, we can sort through in the coming days.
That sounds great. And one other clarification is those projects were specifically set out to, because that's the they were also were in the governor's proposal. Those were the top three priorities for rail grade crossing. So that's also why that made part of the language there. So,
thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein, for all your work on this. Are there any other questions from members? Are there other testifiers who would like to come to the testifying table on this subject? Senator Kent?
Sorry, I was looking to see if someone else was coming down. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if someone from DPS could come and talk about the sensitive information and data practices aspect.
It appears that we do have a representative.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and continue with your testimony. Do you have an initial question for them, Senator Kent?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, I was just wondering if you could, sort of confirm if that is consistent with what has been testified to earlier, is consistent with the department's perspective. And from the data practices side, is there any built-in protection to this type of secure data, or could we have, a legislative solution that could designate certain types of data as non-public?
Mr. Chair, I'm Mark Danaski, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. Mr. Athens was pretty succinct with this going on. We've been working with the emergency managers, the railroad, trying to come up with a means by which we could secure the information that they wanted to share with the emergency managers. What we found was, if I can find my information here, give me just one moment, Mr. Chair. I can't find my original piece to Chapter 13. Under Chapter 13, under the scope of Chapter 13, it discusses that information that's is held by government agencies is public unless otherwise exempted by state statute or by federal statute. And so under a lot of the requirements that the railroads have been asked to do these analysis and their response plans are spelled out in CFR 49 as being required by the federal government. Additionally, under that 49 CFR, sensitive security information is also outlined. And so the connection comes in that the federal government is requiring the railroads to provide these plans. The federal government is identifying them as sensitive security information. And as such, there is a federal statute that says that they are security information. So if they're properly marked and they're properly identified in the system, under Chapter 13, we feel that they would be non-public.
Thank you. That was my assumption as well.
Other questions for members? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this? All right. Seeing none, then we will move on with our agenda. Gentlemen, we're just checking in with Senator Dibble to see if maybe we want to recess for just a little bit so that we can all be here for the next part of the presentation. Really was the walkthrough of what our the House position is, what the Senate position is, really just in hopes that we're all back on the same page and know what we're all here for and looking forward to the continual conference committee of where we need to go from here.
Yeah.
Just as an update, we will stay here. Apparently, the Senate just moved the bill that they were working on, so Senator Dibble will be back here in about 5 minutes. So we will continue at that time. Talk amongst yourselves.
I'm going to go to the left.
Thank you for your patience, and we will move forward. Our plan from here is to, as I said, to highlight the points from both the House and the Senate as we see our bills come together, and what as we're really talking about things, we're down to the a lot of the revenue side of our equation. So we will what we'll do is we'll walk through the House's position on those, and one of our main differences here, or the way we look at the funding, was an initial
Being in a surplus situation here, we're looking at partially some general fund contributions, but we're also or funding, but we're also looking at dedicated sources, because one of the things we heard loud and clear was a 10-year comprehensive plan that has dedicated funding to transportation. So with that, one of our largest changes would be a sales tax on auto parts, and Representative Howe, you carried that legislation, so would you care to comment on it?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, that that bill will not only, it will provide you know, about $348 million annually. It's a bill that a lot of people say it comes from the general fund, but that's a sales tax that we already collect off of auto parts. And with our vehicles lasting longer and people continuing to drive and they keep those vehicles on the road longer, it's good. It's a common sense approach to take that sales tax that we're keeping these older vehicles on the road and dedicate those towards transportation. If you buy a new vehicle, that sales tax goes to transportation. Keeping these older vehicles on the road, that sales tax should go to transportation also. And it also helps that it as those inflation goes on and those auto parts continue to rise, it'll continue to put more into the fund. Where on the other side of the fence, if we do a gas tax, as our vehicles become more and more efficient, it's kind of a loser for us. So it's an attempt to look outside the box at a different way to fund our road projects, and that's the reason this came about, and that's kind of the essence of the bill. Everything that you buy, from windshield wipers to washer fluid to oil to tires to an auto fender will go into this fund. Mr. Chair, if you want me to go further into that, I will, but that's the essence of the bill.
Okay. Thank you for that, Representative Howe. When we move forward with some of the other, as we look at what that funding is for, the 10-year plan, that was approximately $2.6 billion as part of our $7 billion plan to put into transportation over that time period. Some of the other items that we have highlighted are, we had $1 billion of GO bonds, $1 billion trunk highway bonds, but some of the other, following in that same vein of dedicated funds, are sales tax on rental vehicles, and the 9.2% sales tax on rental vehicles was dedicated to a new fund for small cities, the small cities under 5,000 who do not get dedicated funds in any fashion right now. So that has been widely popular. We've heard great response in regards to that new program. So that's where the sales tax on the 9.2 sales tax on rental vehicles went to. The other also dedicated 6.5% sales tax on rental vehicles to a newly created Metropolitan Transit capital account to provide additional spending for local metro transit capital projects. And we carried that out. Let's see, what was that for our total? The small cities account is $281 million over that 10-year time period as well. We had the dollars from the turnback account, $69 million in the 10-year plan. The unreserved fund, and Mr. Lee, you may want to help me out on that as far as what that dollar amount is. We have $430 million on the unreserved fund over that 10-year time period. Can you help me on that, please?
Mr. Chair and members, the House position on House File 4, in addition to revenue raisers, also appropriated funds out of the Trunk Highway Fund that was essentially is on the bottom line from the unreserved trunk highway fund balance, and created a policy in which future forecasts essentially allocate a piece of the of any additional revenue from in that comes into the Trunk Highway Fund balance as a not a statutory appropriation, but as a forecasted base. So.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Lee. And one of the other sales taxes are the motor vehicle lease sales taxes to Greater Minnesota Transit and the County State Aid Highway funds, that $32 million, which was sent to the general fund, and then the overage of the $32 million split 50-50. This would split all the motor vehicle lease sales tax into these funds, which would provide an additional $14 million per year into new funding for these two funds as well. Mr. Lee or Mr. Bruce, have I missed any major funding mechanism that we have included?
Mr. Chair and members, there's also an additional amount of one-time funds from the general fund in the original House position, about $228 million. That was one-time general fund spending for county state aid, municipal state aid, and small cities.
Thank you. Yes, that's our general fund obligation that when we looked at from a standpoint of where we are at, again, economically, our position has been from the start that there are times when we're up here that we do have to prioritize different areas and different funding levels. And in this situation right now, we have heard over and over from most people in this room that transportation is a priority. We've heard from constituents. We've heard from the governor. We've heard from everyone that transportation, it's time to prioritize that, and that we have not done so for quite a while. So in this time period where we are in a surplus situation of $900 million into our budget, we felt that it is okay right now to prioritize and to use general fund dollars to go to transportation. So in summary, our plan going forward is to dedicate basically the sales tax on auto parts and lease tax and anything that we feel is from a transportation standpoint on using our automobiles. We feel that is a very logical step to take to dedicate those funds to transportation. And that's when we talked about those funds going into a transportation stability fund, which would in turn be dedicated to transportation itself. And so at this point in time, I guess I will hand it over to you, Mr. Chair, to highlight your plan.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And let me just say I appreciate some aspects of your bill, the fact that it's, kind of roughly proportional to in some aspects. I think it maybe we're going to have more discussion about transit, but at least on the roads and bridge sizes, it kind of gets in the same arena in terms of addressing the size and scope and scale of the issues and opportunities we have in front of us. If you don't mind, with your indulgence, I did prepare a little bit of a kind of a backgrounder on what underlies in terms of how we view the problem and the opportunity in front of us. So I thought I would lay a little foundation and then just in very high level summary describe our bill and some of the rationale for the elements of that bill, and then our committee members have aspects that they would like to expand upon themselves. So we know, of course, that we haven't had a large transportation bill in about 30 years. We had a kind of a smallish bill in 2008, which was great, and we were happy that we got the 2008 bill passed. But even in 2008, the scale and scope of the problem was pretty well known, and it was confirmed and affirmed a few years later with the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee analysis and report. Part of what is this conversation is about is the fact that we have, a very good and big, robust roadway system in Minnesota, which is a great thing. Everyone's heard me say 1,000 times it's the fifth largest roadway system with the 12th largest area by by geography and about 29th or 30th largest by population. But those roads are old. They're more than half of them are 50 years old. 40% of our state bridges are more than 40 years old. I think now it's been a few years since those statistics were cited, so even older now. And in just a couple of years, one in five Minnesota roads will actually be past their useful life. In the next 10 years, 40% of our roads will be past their useful life. We know that if we don't actually spend some dollars to invest in an economically productive way, kind of through the front door, we pay slips out the back door in many different ways. It's easy to imagine, of course, we pay through lesser economic productivity, congestion, employees who can't get to decent jobs. We're hearing a lot about the job shortage, and a couple of the factors cited are housing that's proximate to where the jobs are and the ability to get to those jobs through transportation. Meanwhile, we have areas of the state where there are a lot of people who need jobs, and so the paradox is kind of striking. We know that people pay quite a bit in extra vehicle repairs. Freight transportation costs caused by congestion are very significant. Minnesota commuters waste 34 hours in traffic every year, and if we don't fix it by 2025, they'll be wasting 45 hours in traffic. That's real money in terms of people's lives. We expect another 800,000 or so people here by 2040. Many of those are going to end up in the metro area, but they're going to hopefully end up in lots of other parts of the state. There's no way we can build sufficient roadway infrastructure to accommodate all those folks. We need to do quite a bit, of course, to connect the interregional centers. And we also need to address a lot of the congestion and tight spots and bottlenecks around the metro. So road and bridge issues are quite real, both in our state system as well as our local system. Local system, of course, represents over 90% of the miles that we have in our state, although the state roadway system, I think, has 80% or more of the actual vehicle miles traveled. So it's kind of an inverse relationship. The number of miles are inverse to the number of vehicle miles traveled. But of course, with 800,000 new people, we're going to have to find better ways of getting folks around. And that's both a land use question, making sure that our land use policies are more intelligent, but also it's finding alternatives, biking, walking, and transit. And that's both in the metro area and in greater Minnesota. And we know that the resources are declining more rapidly than inflation in some instances. And, of course, the workhorse of the Highway User Fund has been the gas tax. And the gas tax is at 28.5 cents per gallon. The state gas tax, if it had been allowed to just grow with inflation, had its current buying power, since we last raised it significantly, it would be at 54.1 cents per gallon. And that's accounting for construction inflation. It's losing ground to inflation, it's losing ground to more efficient, more fuel-efficient cars, and it's losing ground to the fact that lots of folks from all sectors and all walks of life and all ages are driving a whole lot less. So that brings us to where we are. A lot of the bill, of course, keys off of the findings of the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee. We know that just to keep up with to kind of repair the roads and keep up with our potholes, the minimum amount we need to come out of the Highway User Fund into the Trunk Highway Fund is $250 million per year. That's just to maintain what we've got, current level of service. If we're to be what they call economically competitive, by the TFAC was $600 million. We don't even propose to do that in our bill because that's kind of a stretch. We propose to I'll talk in the 18-19 fiscal year because that's kind of the first full fiscal year because we have this funny half fiscal year in the present biennium. So if we look at the 18-19 numbers in the Senate bill, into the Highway User Fund, we'd put about $1.2 billion in that one fiscal year. So that would be obviously little over $600 million per year out of that would flow because we, of course, know that into the Trunk Highway Fund, that's 95%, because the 5% that gets taken off the top. So 62% of that going into the Trunk Highway Fund would be about $353 million per year. For the Trunk Highway Fund, 166 to county state aid highways, 51.4 to municipal state aid. And then $3 million to small cities and townships. So how do we, you know, so how do we justify that, given that we know that we need to be up in the $600 million range or so? And the way we justify that is we ask MnDOT to embark on. We would look at this not as a 20-year initiative necessarily, but more of a 10-year initiative, and come back to this conversation in 10 years. And in the meantime, get up to their level of construction, state road construction that they need to do through, through normal cash outlay like they do now, but also authorize quite a bit more in trunk highway fund bonds, and ask them to come up with some of the delta through efficiencies. In the metropolitan area, the identified need if we're to start to build out the LRT and other transitway systems, most of those would be 20 or so of those lines would be bus rapid transit, so rapid transit on buses that goes on freeways and arterials and the like throughout the metro area. And then also paying for significant new infrastructure for bicycle and pedestrian opportunities. We would propose to bring ourselves up to the level that almost every other region of our type in the entire country, and actually in the entire continent, has, which is a one penny 1% sales tax. So that would bring it from the current quarter cent that exists in the five metro counties. That's the County Transit Improvement Board quarter cent. We would add 3/4 cent to that to come up to the full cent. That would be in the entire seven county metropolitan area. I should back up a step. Let me go back to the sources that go into the Highway User Fund. Those are very quickly. It's this, wholesale tax on gas that we talk about. That would be an equivalent of about 16 cents per gallon. And we also have an increase in license tab fees as well. I can't remember exactly. I'd have to look at my notes how much each of those raises. But like I said, it adds up to about 1.2. Getting back to the transit, the metro area. So we come up to a full cent. And that raises a little north of $400 million per year in the 18-19 biennium. That would allow us, parenthetically, to eliminate any of the general fund appropriation that we do for transit operations in the metro, which comes to about $40 million per year. It'll also allow us to not have to go to the bonding bill, because both the capital and the operating needs for Metro Transit, both expanding the bus system and building the transitways, would be fully taken care of through what Metro Transit receives from just a little bit of the local property tax for capital, motor vehicle sales tax, fares, this sales tax, a little bit of federal dollars that we get as well, and Metro Transit would be pretty set to go. We don't do enough, of course, on local roads, and you identified that as a key issue as well. The identified need in the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee report was about $450 million per year. That's for both property tax-supported local roads as well as those that are supported through the formula. That is a very long reach. I can't quite imagine now how we would get to that, but. So we do have some, these additional revenues I talked about that come out of the formula, which, it's not bad. $166 to CASA, $51 to municipal state aid, but it's not great. So we came up with charging a $10 surcharge on motor vehicle registrations as well as title transfers. Taken together, those raise enough to devote $57 million per year to both small cities as well as cities above 5,000 and above. In the metropolitan area, we know that a lot of the county state aid, the CASA formula, doesn't stay in the metropolitan area. It goes out to greater Minnesota counties because of how that formula and how that's divvied up among counties is construed. And so they continue to fall significantly short because there's so much pressure on county state aid highways. And we have, of course, some of the motor vehicle lease tax that comes to the five counties, not including Hennepin and Ramsey. What we propose to do is take more of the motor vehicle lease tax, not the entire $32 million that goes into the general fund now, but $22 million of that, and distribute those dollars across all seven counties. But we we tamp down the amount that Hennepin and Ramsey get so that we can get more dollars out to the five counties around Hennepin and Ramsey just to support their county state aid highway program. For Greater Minnesota Transit, again, a huge need that goes lacking, and I can't remember the numbers exactly, but at present we fall far short of serving the identified need as regional centers grow economically, more service jobs come online as the population ages, the pressure on rural transit is going to grow quite significantly. And how we propose to at least start to address that is by rejiggering the share of motor vehicle sales tax. The rationale for doing that is that so much additional dollars are coming into Metro Transit through new sources, additional dollars coming to the Highway User Fund through new sources, and so we get additional dollars into rural transit through an 8% share of the motor vehicle sales tax, and I'm not recollecting exactly how much additional that is. How much more do we get over to rural transit through the motor vehicle sales tax, the 8% share?
Mr. Chair, if you give me a second, I'll get you that number. Mr. Chair, the doubling of the MVEST from 4% to 8% for Greater Minnesota Transit will be roughly $29 to $30 million a year.
Okay, thank you. And then finally, the way we propose to do bike ped infrastructure in the metro area would come from the sales tax through a formula that we spelled out in the bill. In Greater Minnesota, we create some active transportation programs and some way to guide the granting of those dollars around the state, and we also have, of course, the existing Safe Routes to School program, infrastructure investments for Safe Routes to School. That's bike and ped initiatives throughout the state, and we do a $5 million ongoing appropriation to the general fund. We do a one-time transfer from the general fund to active transportation. We also make sure that some additional funds that come through federal sources for transit enhancement programs are devoted on a permanent ongoing basis in about $6 million per year to those purposes. We have a small initiative on license plates. I won't get into that. It's not that interesting. Is there anything I'm forgetting, Ms. Boyd? Well, it's very interesting, but not right now. It's extremely interesting. It's a great idea, but I don't want to talk about it right now. Anything I'm missing, Ms. Boyd?
Mr. Chair, there was just, I think you got everything. The one thing I didn't hear was increasing the license plate fees from $10 to $12.50, and that was designed to, did you mention that?
Well, once you mentioned it, I said I wasn't going to because it's kind of boring, but.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'll be boring. Yeah. And then also increasing the replacement period for plates, and that was designed to bring in enough revenue to enable us to eliminate the highway user tax appropriation to DVS that now pays for the plate production.
Yeah, well, so it is a little bit interesting because it helps address some of the leakage from the highway user fund that goes over to DVS for the purpose of their acquiring plates through the Department of Corrections. It makes that more of a self-supporting activity. I'll toss the ball over to my committee members who had a special focus and some issues that they wanted to emphasize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've given a good overview, and I'm just going to focus pretty specifically from an economic perspective, sort of weaving together different things that we've encountered in this process over several years. For one thing, on a timely basis, I want to point out I think all the members received a letter yesterday from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce that I think really makes the case pretty strongly. They say they strongly support sustained increased investment in our roads, bridges, and transit systems. The state's historic budget reserve and surplus give us the opportunity to invest in our infrastructure and reach compromise on how to bring new resources into the transportation system. They go on to say transportation, road, bridges, and transit is essential to a healthy, vibrant business climate in Minnesota. Investing in economic and physical infrastructure is essential to making Minnesota ready for the future, ready for change, and ready to grow. And I just could not agree more. You know, one of the statistics that I ran across that I like to cite all the time, you know, is individual drivers, right? The American Society of Civil Engineers estimates that the average Minnesota driver spends about $400, it's $396, I think was the specific number, on added costs in operating and repairing their vehicles because of the conditions of our roads. You know, so when we think about just the impact to our pocketbooks, because that's the conversation we're all having, is how are we going to pay for this? We're already doing it. I will attest to it, having just replaced a bearing in my wheel that was attributed to that kind of damage. So that's just an individual operator. When you think about a business fleet, when you think about our school districts with their buses, I think those costs go up even higher. We took a tour, our Senate committee did in 2015, to a bunch of areas around the state, and I will not forget testimony that we heard in one community in southern Minnesota. This was an owner of a business who does precision manufacturing, and he talked about, and you can imagine a precision manufacturing business, the amount of resources that have gone into the equipment that they bring in to make the widgets that they make, and the training that has gone into their workforce, and the skill level that their workforce has to produce these products, and they kept having them arrive damaged when they would ship them out, and they figured out they had to load those products in the truck in between the axles in just a certain way to minimize the damage because of what was being inflicted on them in the trucks because of our roads. I thought that was a really sort of eye-opening example of how this is affecting our businesses. Then Senator Dibble made reference to the less direct costs, the lost time, the inefficiencies for businesses. If you have to be at a certain time at a certain place, and that means you have to plan an hour, even though normally it might take you a half an hour to get someplace, and you multiply that across a workforce. And speaking of workforce, 3M is in my district, and you know, a major legacy Minnesota company, and you know, they are looking, as are so many industries across the state, at a retirement of their highly qualified technical workforce in the coming years. Already on the sort of front edge, it's a boomer thing, obviously. And what they really recognize is that we cannot home grow the talent that we need to replace those retiring technical professionals, and that we are going to have to attract people from outside of our state to come here. And as many point out, a lot of people don't like to move here for the weather. We need to have other reasons for them to move here. And when you think about this younger generation of workers, the research is clear. They love to have access to transit. You know, 3M really grew up, you know, in the East Metro in many ways, grew up around bedroom communities of 3M. My very neighborhood in Woodbury was a bedroom community of 3M. And the idea was, let's go out there and get a house with a driveway and a couple of cars and dogs. And this new generation sees a different vision. And so you can imagine, and we're talking about the Gateway Gold Line bus rapid transit line that 3M and all the area business organizations support strongly out there. Instead of the reverse commute from people going from Woodbury to 3M, they might live at a loft in Lowertown, St. Paul, and take the Gold Line out there to work, and then take the Gold Line back to Lowertown for a ball game, for a dinner, for a concert. It's a different lifestyle that people my generation have grown up with in Minnesota, but you can see where that's important if we are going to attract the workforce we need. And Senator Dibble made a point about, you know, the fact that people need jobs and that there are jobs that are being unfilled, and that is so true in my community. When you go a little further out east and get closer to Wisconsin, there are good jobs that are going unfilled because people can't get to them. There are a lot of jobs that are badly needed between here and there, and it's not that far. You know, it's not that far, and so we need to make sure we have options for people to get around. A recent Harvard study pointed out that the number one predictor of economic mobility, the American dream, is access to transportation. So that's why I've heard loud and clear that the economic argument for now and into the future is so strong that we make this commitment. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I just want to talk real quickly about Quarters of Commerce. That's a program that's pretty new, and I was involved with it right away. We want to put $200 million a year,
for 4 years for $800 million. But the reason that I think this is important to concentrate on and look at is there were over 600 projects that came out the first year that we did that, that needed funding or asking for funding to be completed. It's not just the state roads that I'm concerned about when it comes to the total package on what we're doing. Corridors of Commerce is important because those roads just haven't been getting the funding that they need for numbers of years. And unless we do something comprehensive, those projects just will not be completed. And for one project that I have in my district is $250 million. So just 1 year's of funding isn't even going to complete one project. So how long do we wait then to do the 600 projects that are on that list? Is it going to be 600 years? I mean, they're not all as expensive as the one in my district. But the other thing I want to talk about is the other part of the dedicated funding that comes from a gas tax goes towards our city streets, our county roads. And if we're looking at, which we already are, looking at other ways to raise revenue because we're not able to, for some reason, figure out a way to get sustainable revenue into the system, our local communities are faced with the decision of imposing either the wheelage tax, which is $10, and in 2018 it's going up to $20, or to impose a sales tax. So people are paying a tax already, because our local communities do not have the availability to get what they could get if we put it into the trunk highway fund through some kind of user fee. If we're talking about a user fee, I think that's a gas tax. I think that's also license tax. But if we use sales tax for auto parts, that does come out of the general fund. That's not a guess, or it will be removed out of the general fund. So a lot of people to keep in mind is what happens if we do not have a surplus. If we're in a deficit, which could be next year, if we're in a deficit next year, what happens to our communities where the only increase or the only availability is going to be other taxes that they're already imposing, which is wheelage or sales or property tax, if that's also an option. People are going to have to pay that tax. It's not a gas tax, but it's another one. But the problem is not every community has the retail sales to actually raise enough revenue to do a project. So this is a huge concern of mine. I honestly believe if we're looking at this, and I heard the chair say right now it makes common sense. Right now it makes common sense because we have a surplus. In the future, it will not make sense if we're in a deficit, which could be next year or the next year after that. And the ones that will be hurt are those smaller counties, cities, and townships that do not have the availability to try to find another way to raise revenue. And I don't think we should be putting our local communities into that position where they're forced, where they're then having to make the decision to impose a tax. It makes sense for us to think about that when we're coming up with a comprehensive plan. And that should include a tax increase user fee to make sure that these counties that rely on everyone in the state to provide enough funding to do their projects, the availability to have a really good transportation system too. That's the only way we're going to get it all the way across the state.
Senator Brennan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I echo my colleagues' comments, Senator Jensen and Senator Kent. I will tailor my comments to a couple of programs that we have in place. First of all, I want to say thank you for mentioning the Safe Routes to School program, which is one of the bills I've been carrying, legacy from Senator Dibble. He's previously been the author of that bill, and it's a legacy we have from our late Congressman Jim Oberstar, who started the program at the federal level, and we've made some progress here in Minnesota at the state level. In our current bonding proposal in the Senate, we have $3 million in bonding allocated there. Right now, MnDOT has, my understanding, given grants up to $2 million for about 60 schools across our state, many in our districts. The district that I represent is Edina, West Bloomington, Eden Prairie, Minnetonka, and it's a suburban district where certainly has taken advantage of some state routes to schools. grants and certainly interested in expanding that because there is need, and transportation is not just roads and bridges, it's sidewalks and walkability and all those things that we sometimes forget but use every day to take our kids to school and to walk over across the street to the, you know, the grocery or the nearby store, to walk our kids around, and we need to be cognizant that we haven't really invested any much funding in that either, and that our communities are growing and we're growing in population. Certainly we want to make sure that this piece, which sometimes is not something we think about, coming to and from school and taking your kids and walking and not just relying on busing and everything else that we are so accustomed to. It's got a health benefit. I also serve in the Health and Human Services Committee, so I'm very cognizant of the other benefits that we need to tie into, not working in silos, but how this portion of our budget helps other portions of our budget and maybe even make it cheaper for us to deliver services as people and young kids are actually walking and are healthier. But the other piece I wanted to also mention is the TED program, and many of you are familiar with it. For those who are not, it's a program that we've been funding for the last few years, and this last year in 2015, we funded it at the tune of $32 million. And we had the press conference and unveiling of the projects that received funding in Bloomington in my district, and we, with the project that was funded on I-494 and East Bush Lake Road interchange, and that project received an $8 million grant, but the project total cost estimate is 23.8. So it's great that we got the grant, very thankful, but certainly not the answer to all the needs that we have for that particular project. This project and the part of the TED program, if you're not familiar, it's a joint effort between the Department of Transportation and DEED, Department of Employment and Economic Development, basically trying to grow jobs when we spend some money on roads and bridges and projects like that. In this particular area, we are projecting to exceed 2,500 jobs, which in the next 2 years, if the project is funded and delivered. So it's a good investment, and I would argue a good return on our investment, and something that will help us grow as a state to be able to deliver services as people have jobs and good-paying jobs that they can get to and not waste time on the road getting to those jobs. But I just want to give folks a quick rundown. This unveiling of $32 million might seem like a lot, but we were able to only fund five projects in the Twin Cities metro area and only six projects in greater Minnesota. If I go through the list, I can certainly make this available for folks, but Carver County, just for illustration purposes, a $3.5 million TED grant out of a project total estimate cost of $16.8 million, growing 300 jobs. There's a gap there. Dakota County, TED grant of $3 million, $3.1 million, total project cost $22.3 million, and an estimated 172 to full-time jobs to 322 part-time jobs. But there's a gap there. We got to fill in that gap with something. And I can go on and on with these, a list of under 20 projects that we funded in 2015. And if we think we're going to be able to solve all of our transportation issues one time, well, we all know that's not an option. And I think that's why we're here, and I think our fellow Minnesotans are tired of us just talking about this and tired of us just trying to patch a hole. people are relying on us. Our constituents are relying on us to fill that gap, fill that hole, and build new roads and provide transit and provide that sidewalk that will make it easier and more accessible for folks with disabilities to also partake in our economy. So, you know, we talk about the House position on transportation and using the general fund dollars, but we have a huge strain in our general fund dollars, and what are you willing to cut? What are you willing to defer? And we need to know what that is, because it's not just going to come out of, you know, this random bucket. It's going to come out of schools. It's going to come out of healthcare or housing. And I just don't see that's the most prudent way for us to move forward. Yes, it might be logical, because there's fund there, funding there, but every legislature has to pick those priorities, and it could be our legislative priority this year to do that, but next year, who knows? And I just don't think that's fair for Minnesotans who are expecting us to do our job and to once and for all stop talking about it and have a plan for the next 10 years. That's reasonable. Let's stop, you know, playing with transportation and actually, you know, actually rolling up our sleeves and finally giving our hardworking Minnesotans the peace of mind that we did our job. And once you go out there this summer and door knock and talk to people, they're going to ask you, what did you do? And I'm not ready to sign off on a compromise that doesn't really get us there. And I hate to draw a line in the sand, but at the same time, we have a lot of gaps. And we need to find a way to do that prudently, fiscally, responsibly. But I don't think just counting on the one-time solution like we have in the past, and I'm grateful that we got some funding for that Bloomington interchange, but there's a bigger one in Bloomington, 494 and 35W, which is the 17th most congested intersection bottleneck in the entire country. That's $85 million just to do the first phase. So one-time money isn't going to do it either. It's going to have a gap. When we just need to be planful. Like Minnesotans are with their budgets and with their life, they try to be planful and plan ahead and work hard. They expect us to plan ahead and work hard too. So those are two different, really small pieces of what we could be doing and what we're doing now to fill in the gap. TED is great, but it fills in the gap. Corridors of commerce is great, but it just fills in the gap. Or leaves the gap, excuse me. And you know, I'm committed to working with your ideas and finding a way that we can find that compromise, but let's use a little bit more than logic to get us through. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Schmidt.
You saw a pattern developing here. In any event, I just want to reiterate the comments of my colleagues. I think the emphasis on state highways, county, state aid, funding, municipal state aid, streets, counties, cities, and township road funding, all this is incredibly important for the part of the state I represent, and not to mention the TED funding, Corridors of Commerce. And I appreciate the opportunity to get a little bit more specific tonight, and I'm eager to find common ground on a comprehensive transportation funding package that is both sufficient and sustainable. So at this point, I'd like to say I'm cautiously optimistic that we're moving in that direction. However, I have some concerns with the proposal that we're seeing from the House today that removes $4 billion from the general fund over the next 10 years. And I think you look at the past decade, what Minnesota's been through, a period of recurring budget deficits, a couple of government shutdowns. I think many of those on this side of the table ran in 2012 to address that lingering budget problem and to help Minnesota balance our budget once and for all, as we'd say. Well, we've done that. But in the decade preceding that, we saw cuts to essential services throughout the state, shifts to school funding, local government cuts, increases in property taxes. We don't want to repeat that. And it gives me personal caution to look at removing $4 billion from the general fund over a decade. And so we're on solid fiscal footing, finally. We've seen strong economic growth in Minnesota, which has given us a one-time budget surplus this year. But there are warning signs on the horizon. And just in February, the state economist issued their February economic budget forecast, downgraded projected surpluses by 25%. We've since been issued warning that we can't expect revenues to continue, we shouldn't expect revenues to continue to rise as they have in recent years. I think if there's ever been a time for us to be cautious, it's now. And so my concerns with the proposal that we're seeing from the House is just it relies much too heavily upon general fund dollars, not only this year but in the years ahead. And what sort of position does that put future legislatures in, whether it's 2 or 4 years down the road or next year, in terms of finding funding for education, for local government, for providing property tax relief? I know just recently we've heard from a lot of our constituents in home and community-based services about the need for pay increases. And this is a vital service that's provided around the state. Well, if we don't have the funding in the general fund, where are we going to find that funding? And I think it just speaks volumes to the fact that if we rely too heavily upon the general fund for transportation funding, we are crowding out investments in necessary areas, in human capital, in education, in other aspects of infrastructure. We can't tie our hands, especially given the past decade that we've seen in Minnesota with recurring budget deficits, multiple state government shutdowns, and a lot of the state budget burden shifted to our local governments, in our schools, in our property taxpayers. So that, I guess that tenor of fiscal responsibility, of making sure that we are not relying too heavily upon the general fund. Times are good now, but they may not be in a couple of years. It gives me pause to put too much stock into the proposal from the House. But nonetheless, I think we're in the same ballpark on the level of funding we're looking at, and I'm cautiously optimistic that there's a path forward for a comprehensive transportation funding package that is both sufficient and sustainable. And I think that's what we've got to focus on. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair, did we talk you into our proposal?
Beat us into submission with it?
No, I appreciate all the thought and comments. Before we move to some comments by the House side, I will say I hear Senator Schmidt, you're right. I hear a theme, and that's one of the issue of that we're taking dollars from the general fund, and I just don't understand the whole idea when the general fund did not become. When it became the education fund, or when it became the health care fund. The general fund is the state budget of Minnesota. We have both bodies have committed to roughly $600 million into the budget for transportation. That's about 1.5% of a $42 billion budget. If we can't commit to that on a long-term basis in a 10-year plan, which we've done, and if we can't get the dollars on an ongoing basis, I would suggest it's our fault as Transportation Committee members that we haven't stressed the importance of that over those years. If we're behind, this is the general budget. We prioritize. 1.5% of that budget that we've committed to, $600 million, does not touch the general fund. So to suggest that the general fund is off limits for transportation, I'm having a hard time getting my arms around that. Then we have to do a better job as committee members to stress the importance of it. We have to do a better job as lobbyists and as counties and cities to make sure that the state understands that this is the state budget. So let's move on. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I'm going to refresh a couple of memories here. I noticed as the facts dribbled out that there could have been some corrections made at that time. By the way, the gas tax has pretty well stabilized and is improved. It's not showing less money coming in, and people are driving more. If you pay attention to the current statistics, there also was a record sale of cars in the last 12 months, if anybody knows that, which means that the other parts of the Constitution dedicated monies are increasing. Now, we talk about sustainability, and I will remind you of MBES, Motor Vehicle Sales Tax, as being sustainable only until the whim of the legislature came along and changed it. And that's what we're talking about here with the other use of general fund monies. That was in and out of transportation for quite a while, and we finally went to a constitutional amendment to make that sustainable. And that's in over 6 years, that was the balance of that money came out of the general fund and was dedicated to transportation needs. Now we've got another thing that says to me sustainability, and that's the constitutionally dedicated monies. Whether or not they're there, if the legislature chooses to move them, they're not sustainable. And that's what the argument here is. That means that your gas tax, your tap fees, and your sales taxes are sustainable as long as they come into the Highway User Trust Fund. If people move those around to use for other things, they can't do that because they are sustainable. And that's what the word is you should be using for sustainable. Now, we go back to 2008, but I'll go back to 5 and 7. Those were the first time that the gas tax was raised in over 20 years. And as a matter of fact, the 2005 bills was $7.7 billion. But that was also the constitutional amendment that moved the MBES out of there into Highway User Distribution Trust Fund. I love that. And in the meantime, when we came back with the 07, that was vetoed, you know that. And the 07 bill was only $6.6 billion because we had taken that chunk out of there, which was also vetoed. And that was about a third of what we needed at that time. Everybody knew that. But they also compromised and got that much out of every soul that was able to vote for that. And those were bipartisan bills. Both sides voted for those going out of the House. And when they went to the governor, both sides voted for them. But the governor vetoed, and that was the big sop there when they would say, do we really want to get this money? And of course, you know, the bridge fell down, and so some of us decided we override the governor, and that was then that wasn't bipartisan anymore. So that equivalent monies would be about 10 to 12 billion now. So they weren't minuscule, as you were saying, Senator. They were beyond that. And for the times, they were very good. Now, you would talk about sales tax and this and so forth. The local units, the government, have another method of raising money for their roads, and that's the property taxes. And that's what they were losing in that period. And the cities, I would call, give me the amount of money that you're spending on your roads from your property taxes. And the various metropolitan cities could tell you they are raise their taxes 5%, 6%. And now, he's talking about the little old lady who's sitting watching TV and her property taxes is going up rather than she doesn't drive anymore. And, you know, our population is going to that way. There's going to be a lot of them sitting around watching TV and you think we want to raise their property taxes to make sure that we fix our roads. We want the users. And that's what we're talking about with the gas tax, the tap fees and the sales fees. We were talking about programs. TED, Corridors of Commerce. Those are programs for spending. They're not programs for raising money. They're programs for spending. What we have to do is figure out how to raise the money before we fund TED, or the Quarters of Commerce, or any other name we want to come up for. So let's not say, well, we've got these great programs, and they are good for delivery once you raise the money. And all of that came about because people were willing to compromise now. I had the Chamber of Commerce in today. Bentley was in talking to me today about all the good things that the Chamber wanted us to do. And that long letter that came out, Norris, nobody ever offered to pay for it, though. I said, why don't you go back to him and ask how, and I said some choice words, as a matter of fact. They could hear me down the hall. Why don't you go back and ask how they want to pay for this? You know, they want, transit, and they should. And we've got to move those workers around to get them to their places of business in a area that, like the Twin Cities. That's difficult. We want to protect the environment, and the more transit we get in there, the better job we're doing on that affair, with the chance of bringing less gas in the cars, and yes, they are bringing less. And we're not doing anything about taxing that portion which is escaping our gas tax either, because nobody seems to want to bite on that one. And there have been some other suggestions made, like the user fee on mileage. And I was asked to remove that when they suggested that in front of the committee. They said, I think it'd be a good idea if you take that bill back because otherwise we're going to defeat it. What were we thinking again? What's going on around the country? Oregon's got five counties or so, or under this kind of a program, testing it. We did a pilot program, but it needed much more refining. California is doing this, and that is of future, but it has a lot of infrastructure problems that needs to be done. In the meantime, the old steady ones, like the gas tax and the tab fees and the sales taxes, go on producing money, so we don't have to have the little old lady have her taxes raised to property taxes raised to pay for something that she's not using. So we still need to compromise, and I've been talking about compromise for a year and a half, as have others. The Minneapolis Speaker has twice written editorials on compromise. I won't go into the details on compromise, but I think that both sides here have got a hell of a lot to learn about compromise. That's the essence of what we're doing here, and this whole big mess is compromise. So I'll save that for another time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Earhart.
Any other comments from House members? Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm pretty optimistic that Representative Earhart, we will be able to compromise and end up with a solid bill. But Mr. Chair, I do share your sentiments as well on the general fund, and a couple of reasons. Number one, transportation. And, supplying our state with quality roads and bridges and infrastructure is constitutionally directed at the legislature. And, we look at the general fund spending, we spend about 2% on transportation right now. A lot of that is administrative and it's all good, but we've really abdicated the general fund spending, our main job. I would say one of our main jobs per the Constitution, and moved all that outside of the general fund. Now, I think it's important for something that's so important to also be in the discussion. Yes, that might make our job a little more difficult. But you know what? When I was elected in 2008, right off the heels after the gas tax, which was supposed to solve so many problems and set us up for such a great future for transportation funding. Here we are just a few years later, right back in the same spot. And we're spending about $31, $32 billion a year out of the general fund. Now we're up to about $40-some billion out of the general fund. And we still have the same problems. And our priorities are growing and growing, and we can't seem to find a program or a worthy cause that isn't worth funding, yet we still continue to have this massive problem when it comes to transportation. So you know what? This is our job. We are constitutionally told that this is a duty and responsibility that we have, and I think that it should be a priority that deserves some general fund dollars. And that should be an ongoing conversation. On top of that, there seems to be some sort of disconnect that we're okay with a sustainable or longer-term transportation funding plan coming outside of the general fund, and Senator Jensen's advocating for the gas tax increase. It's the same pot of money. Our taxpayers are paying into the general fund. Our businesses are paying into the general fund. And that gas tax you want to increase is coming from our taxpayers and from our businesses. It's the same pot of money. We're just asking for them to do our work themselves, and saying that we're going to abdicate our responsibility again, and we'll just push the cost off on you guys, and we'll continue to fund other priorities and other programs instead of transportation or in place of transportation. So I think that having the general fund hook in there for transportation is extremely important. It's something that the Minnesota Constitution says that we need to do, and because of that, I think some general fund dollars should always be on the line and should be a part of the conversation. What is the priority for the state of Minnesota? And if we're asking our taxpayers to go back and pay additional gas tax for something that hopefully or we thought back in 2008 was going to solve the problem, there better be some pretty good data that's going to show them that, well, hopefully this is the last time, or, you know, we've done this to them enough, in my opinion, to the taxpayers. You know, I think it's our turn to kind of shoulder some of the burden and make sure that we have the logical and the fiscal responsible plan to put forth. But I think between the two bodies, I think we literally have about every option on the table. And so I think that, you know, by the end of the day, I think we'll end up with a good product that Minnesota can be proud of.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to all of you for sharing your thoughts. I truly believe that we're all here and on Transportation Committee, and we've learned about it because we do have that passion, and we do have the willingness to really do what is best for the state of Minnesota and transportation. One of the things that I'm starting to hear is that we have kind of built up this idea that we are prioritizing transportation this year for our bonding bill. But what that implies when we say, we can't do anything else other years or we've got to do it all this year, is that it's no longer going to be a priority next year or the following year. And I think that's a bad message to send out to the community and to the state. I think it needs to be a priority every year, not just this year. I think it needs to be a priority every year. And that means that we have to constantly promote it. And I think a couple of people, including Chair Kelly, who talked about that is our responsibility as transportation people is to promote it. I'm very surprised by the fact that we say this is a priority, that the number one priority of this session is transportation, and yet the $900 million that we have in the surplus that's there, that's being held back and spent by other proposals other than ours on things that have less priority. That seems to contradict the idea of whether or not transportation truly is our priority for this year. Representative Earhart talks about how people who drive on the roads, that they ought to be the ones that pay for it. They're the ones that are users. We don't do that for education. We don't do that for transit. We don't do that for most everything. The reality is that as Representative Earhart said, grandma sitting at home is very much dependent upon the roads and bridges, even if she never drives a vehicle, because her commerce, all the stuff that comes to her house that she consumes, public safety, all of that depends on roads and bridges. And so it's not always just tied to just user fees and others. So as we think about our rhetoric and how we think about how we compromise and deal with it, I think one of the things we need to keep in mind is that if we're going to have a sustainable funding source and a sustainable policies and budgets each and every year, it requires us to discuss it along with the importance of every other aspect of state government. And if we continually to think that we can do a priority every 10 years and set it off to the side, every 10 years we're going to have this emergency. And so it's got to be something that we continually talk about all the time and put it in practice. So I would highly say it's time for us to meet somewhere at least in the middle and to think about how we can produce a bill that allows us to invest with the dollars that are constituents and voters have sent us here. They didn't send us here to make the easy decisions. They didn't. They asked us here to really decide how to deal with the funds that they have given us already. Let's deal with that first before we think about how we need to take more dollars. I can tell you in greater Minnesota that there have been more referendums, especially school bond referendums, that have lost because it increased somebody's property tax by $100 a year. The gas tax would do a lot more than that. So it does impact people in greater Minnesota, and I think they do think about it all the time, and I think we need to really consider how we prioritize the funding that we already have. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Howell, I believe you're the only representative or senator we haven't heard from yet. Would you like to speak on this?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And you know, when we talk about getting people to jobs and getting and products to commerce, in my district, that takes roads and bridges, and that takes cars and trucks. And you raise the gas tax
out there, and that comes right out of their pockets, and it hits the lowest comedy not the lowest income people we have, the people driving the 20-year-old vehicle that's putting money in to keep it running. It hits them the hardest. It hits them the worst. They've got no option to grab a bus. They can't call an Uber cab out there. They're relying on their vehicle to get to work. And when you raise the gas tax, that hurts them. I see calculated, estimated about $180 a year. That's money they can't afford. And that's the lowest, that's the low-income people that have that minimum wage job, and that's who we're going to hurt the worst out in greater Minnesota. So how do we fix that? Gas tax is the most regressive tax on them that we can hit them with. When the gas prices were way high and they came down, MMB said that was like a tax cut. That's when we started seeing more revenues. When the gas tax went down, people out there had more money to spend. And that went right into our state coffers. It helped our revenue. And now we're looking at, when MMB said that was like a tax cut, we're looking at making the most regressive tax increase on the people that can least afford it. And I struggle with that. Because in my district, you can't get a bus, you can't get a cab, no one comes to pick you up to take you there, you have to drive. They have no other options. So I'm very sensitive to the fact that we're talking about hitting those folks that can least afford it. I would say that, you know, not that I am optimistic because it looks like our numbers are very similar. I'm optimistic we can come to a compromise and get something done. But keep in mind, let's not hurt the very people that can least afford it. And 16 cents a gallon is huge to those people. So let's keep in mind what that, you know, and I agree with Representative Petersburg, everyone, even though they don't drive, relies on roads and bridges because those products and those goods have to ride on the highway to get where they're going. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Powell. At this point in time, members, we will allow for some public testimony, but I would ask, because we have been here quite a while, that we would hold our any questions for them at this point in time. We will allow them to come up and testify at this point, and at this point, I guess we would ask you to be concise with your comments, if you could please, and let's start this. Who from the public would like to testify? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm the Director of Healthcare and Transportation Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, as was referenced earlier. I want to thank you all for the level of commitment you have to this issue and the commitment you've shown to this process and to this discussion. We greatly appreciate the amount of discussion here tonight and, you know, frankly, in the last year about the opportunities for compromise, the opportunities for common ground to be found on this issue. That's actually reflected in something that's being handed out now. We've worked collaboratively over the, you know, basically in the interim and since the beginning of session with a number of our colleagues in the business community, both at the business partnership and at the Associated General Contractors, but then also with a number of our friends in the labor trades do a lot of work in transportation, and really put our heads together in interim to try and figure out, you know, how we could work together collaboratively, cooperatively, to help support getting a bill done this session, recognizing the opportunity that we have. Out of that came the op-ed that is being handed on to you now. I know with all of you as conferees, we as a group have met with each of you individually, and so this is certainly not new to you, but we wanted to take advantage of the opportunity here this evening to kind of make this pitch again publicly to you as a group, and so I hope you'll certainly bear with us in doing that. But you know, as you know, that op-ed stresses the need for compromise, for a way forward to ensure that we take advantage of the unique opportunity we have this year to get a bill done. But it also recognizes we need to have a comprehensive bill, a sustainable bill, a long-term bill that provides the roads, bridges, and transit. We as the chamber do support the use of the general fund, using the sales tax on auto parts and rental cars to fund further investment in our transportation system. We think that makes policy sense. We think it is a smart way to broaden the base of financial support for our transportation system here in Minnesota. We hear from businesses very regularly that they see transportation as a core function of the state government, and this is a good way to bring in transportation-related dollars to support that service. But we also believe that this has to be, again, a comprehensive bill. It has to be roads, bridges, and transit. Transit both in greater Minnesota and in the metro area. We recognize that our transit systems are vitally linked for businesses and individuals across the state. We have really tried hard to stress that must be part of a comprehensive bill. And I appreciate the level of discussion that's been focused on that here this evening as well. With that, I also just want to draw your attention, and Senator Kent already highlighted this earlier, but a letter that went out to you all as legislators just yesterday from a number of local chambers from across the state, re-emphasizing that same message of a comprehensive bill that provides for roads, bridges, and transit. And I think also, again, kind of coming back to where I started my testimony, brings us back to the work that we've done with a number of our colleagues across a good cross-section of stakeholders in transportation. And so I appreciate the opportunity to kind of reinforce that message here today. I'll turn it over to my colleague from the partnership, and then I think you'll hear from a couple of our colleagues from the construction industry and the trades as well. But thank you for all the work you've done to get us to this point, and we look forward to working with you to get this across the finish line. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Jill Larson. I'm from the Minnesota Business Partnership. I will echo Mr. Graves' comments. We, too, support a comprehensive transportation bill that includes funding for roads, bridges, and transit. We do believe that the House approach in terms of using some of the general fund to supplement the existing revenue streams makes sense. It is a priority for the business community, and as such, we believe that it's appropriate to use some general fund money for transportation. We do have a large surplus. We have a very large budget reserve, and we think that this is an opportunity this year to come together and to reach agreement on a transportation bill that everybody can support. We understand the need for compromise. We do support additional funding for transit. We hope the conference committee will be able to come to resolution on that. We stand ready to work with all of you to get a bill done that everybody can support. Thanks.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Chair Dibble and members of the conference committee. My name is Kyle Macarios. I work for the Carpenters Union and work closely with a number of the other union construction trades. We want to state, and we've been very happy to work with the business community on what we think is a path toward a compromise bill that can get done this session. We want to state where business invests, locates, and grows its business here in Minnesota. That's what keeps our members working every day, both on the construction projects that you all fund and transportation, but more importantly on the businesses who develop and grow their businesses alongside those transportation corridors. We think it's critical that a deal get done this session. That is comprehensive, that is long-term, and that has real new money for transit systems. I want to say, Mr. Chairman, that I really like the expressed optimism that we heard from both members of the House and the Senate just a few minutes ago. As you well know, that is not what the media is saying. They are not expressing that same optimism. The pundits aren't expressing that same optimism. But I'm with you all. I think that we really can get a deal done this year, and I hope that that we collectively can make that happen from both sides of the aisle and from the House and the Senate can come together put aside some of the differences and focus on some of the similarities and the shared priorities that we heard expressed today. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Abby Breideck. I represent the Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. We're a nonprofit association that represents general and specialty contractors, as well as material and service suppliers in the construction industry. And we've been working closely with the colleagues that have gone before me, as we've mentioned, visiting with all of you, talking about the needs for a bill, and encouraging all to work together and come up with a compromise. And, you know, I think, as my the previous testifiers have said, there are certainly enough options out there where we could put together, I think, a bill that would bring some meaningful revenue, new revenue to transportation, looking at, you know, traditional and newer sources and avenues to go to draw from. We also want to reiterate our support for a bill that's comprehensive, that includes investments both for the metro area, greater Minnesota, as well as roads and transit. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a handout. For the record, my name is Margaret Donahoe. I'm the director of the Minnesota Transportation Alliance. And as you know, our alliance includes counties, cities, the Township Association, major employers in the highway construction industry, labor unions, transit systems, ports association, and other advocates. We thank you very much for all the work you've done this session and last session in passing major transportation funding bills through both the House and Senate. And as others have said, we believe that there are plenty of options on the table, that we pretty much support all of them, and hope that you can find a way to come to a compromise this session, because the longer this waits, the more expensive this problem becomes. And as I've passed out, it is not just the stakeholders in transportation who are talking about the huge level of need. But as you can see, legislators have introduced this biennium over 90 bills for specific transportation projects. You've heard, I think, many of them in committee. But when you look at the total, it's over $2 billion in spending that's needed to get these projects done. And we want to see these projects done. But with current funding levels, these projects won't get done. So we just want people to understand these are real projects that communities have been waiting for, sometimes for many, many years. And they create jobs, they create economic development, and it's important that they get done, because they will become more expensive the longer this drags on. I just want to close with one other thing that was not brought up today, just to put on your radar screen. But kind of along the lines of the House looking at the Trunk Highway Fund balance, there was, as you know, federal funding passed the FAST Act in December, and we anticipate additional highway dollars for Minnesota in the Trunk Highway Fund. But we need an increase in the Trunk Highway Fund appropriation in order for MnDOT to take advantage of those dollars. The governor's recommended increasing the Trunk Highway Fund appropriation by $90 million for this biennium. It's not in the supplemental budget bill, so we hope that this bill could be a place to make sure that that happens, so those federal dollars can also be spent right away. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ken Snowblom, here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Townships. Our 1,781 townships, 56,000 miles of roads, 6,000 bridges. We are the single largest road authority in the state as far as the number of miles and bridges that we maintain. But we do it on a very with very small, limited local budgets. We are currently at a ratio of 72% property tax dependent for our township needs, more than half of which are road and bridge related. 72%. We've had townships defer projects to the point where 3 weeks ago, when we had our legislative conference, we had a report of a township that finally said, we're at desperation. Our members just, our citizens just approved an 80% 80% increase in our levy because we've deferred road maintenance, waiting for the state to help, and we just can't do it anymore. The need is absolutely now. Now, our association has long supported a reasonable periodic increase in the gas tax. We continue to do so. One thing that did come out of our conference was absolutely instructions to myself and to Mr. Vanosik as we work on the session to look at all options that are on the table, which would include the capturing of the sales tax, as Representative Powell's bill looks to with a constitutional amendment possible attached to that. By the numbers I heard today, that would raise approximately, for townships, approximately $6 million a year. Our estimated need is $15 million a year. So whether we look at the gas tax, whether we look at the capturing, we're getting partway there unless we do look at big pictures and adding everything up. So as we look at compromise, it's not just a matter of compromising whose proposal where. It's a matter of, are we getting an equal distribution to all the users? And for us, that has to be through the high user trust fund and getting to that need of $15 million a year or more. So I just want to put that out there. I'm happy to come to any office that has ideas. I'm happy to have these conversations. But sales tax, not an option at the townships. We don't have retail. Wheelage tax, not a good option because all it does is burden the county to tax themselves, then share the revenue with us. We need state resources, and we need it now. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Michael Potter. I'm a commissioner from Wright County. Myself and Commissioner Brown from Olmsted County created an op-ed that's running in certain papers around the state here. And we're growing with the frustration of not getting something done. I'm hearing a lot of testimony today. It sounds like they're getting somewhere. They're getting close. They got a little compromised, willing to compromise. But the problem for the counties has been the last decade, it's been really tough to keep on top of this transportation thing. As county commissioners, we've been trying to pick up the slack in the last few years. About 80% of the counties have either adopted a wheelage tax or sales tax to try to bridge that gap, but it's still not nowhere near enough. And we're asking you to step up and actually get this done because, as you know, our roads, bridges, everything is getting older. And we need, and we do believe, quite a few of us do believe, that gas tax needs to be part of the solution. Not saying it's the whole solution. I agree with Representative Powell that you can't just rely on that, but it needs to be part of a solution on this. We're concerned that, you know, the sustainable long term, because we can't plan for 5 and 10 year plans if we don't have that commitment from this body here. We're fortunate, we're happy that the feds have finally come forward with something, the FAST Act, which is good, but we still need it from the legislature. One of the things that have recently come to mind, I'm also a member of the Greater MSP, which we have some issues coming up with Greater MSP. We compete against peer cities, Dallas, Denver, Seattle, Atlanta, and we're predicting a 100,000 worker shortage. Concerns at Greater MSP is that if we don't invest in the transportation transit here, we are going to fall behind, and we're holding our own pretty good right now, but eventually we're going to be on the back end of this. And these people, like the 3M and the rest of them that need these workers, we need to recruit them from other states. And the only way we're going to get them here is if we show them that we have the transportation, the transit system that's there. One of the other things from the Tax Foundation that came out recently is a lot of the states around us have increased gas tax, some by a nickel, some by 18 cents. It's all over the board. Even one in Congressman Schuster from Pennsylvania is convinced his state, they raised their gas tax 18 cents. That's top in the nation of far as increase. And they zoomed right up from 15 to number one. We've gone down from number 20 to 25. We've stayed stagnant. Well, Iowa raised their gas tax 10 cents, South Dakota 8 cents just in the last year here. I'm not saying that's a cure-all of everything, but it has to be part of the solution. I hope that you can see through to get all these considerations done. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Ann Finn, and I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. We are a statewide association representing 833 of Minnesota's 853 cities. I want to first thank you for all the work that you have done and for the work that we think you're going to do. We want to let you know that our city officials stand with you in wanting to get something done, and that I personally am committed to making sure that we get good information out to them and that the difficult decisions that you'll have to make will be supported at the local level. We do support, as you've heard from the previous testifiers, a comprehensive, dedicated transportation funding bill, and we would like to see it be a multimodal bill. One provision in particular that we have heard a lot of support for among city officials is the $10 surcharge on the tab fees and the surcharge on the license transfer fee that would be for city streets. It would go toward the small city's assistance account as well as for non-municipal state aid streets in municipal state aid cities. That's a very important provision for us. 84% of the streets in cities are funded with property taxes. So they're not on any funding system other than special assessments and property taxes. And that system of streets is terribly aged. And we think that this provision is a nice start toward getting at least back on track with some maintenance and reconstruction of those streets. I have a letter for you that I'm sorry I don't have with me today, but you'll be getting it by tomorrow. In the last few days, we've asked mayors to sign on to a letter supporting this provision, and within hours, we had nearly 50 signatures. They're from cities of all sizes, some of our smallest cities as well as our largest, and I will make sure that's in your hands in the next day. Again, that provision is critical to us, and you have the support of the League's board as well as hopefully the city officials in your own communities. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Sherry Munyon, and I represent the Minnesota Public Transit Association. The association is comprised of bus operators across the state of Minnesota. First, I want to thank both of you. In each of the bills, there is dedicated funding for Greater Minnesota Transit. There's a growing need for service in Greater Minnesota. There's an effort to provide more service to the workforce, to education, as well as to the growing senior population. So the needs have been increasing dramatically. We know we're facing the silver tsunami in the state of Minnesota as people lose the keys to their car rather than being forced to stay in a home. They would like to have the option to ride public transit so they can be active members of the community. We support a comprehensive bill. The Public Transit Association has always supported increased revenues for roads and bridges. Obviously, the buses ride on roads and bridges, and we strongly want to see that those are safe roads and bridges. As we look at dedicated funding, as I said, you both have a proposal for dedicated funding. We do think that if the bill becomes smaller than the Senate bill, the proposal in the House on the lease vehicle revenue may be more viable. We've heard some concerns about the MVES shift, so that is one thing to keep in mind. However, you're able to work out the compromise. Having a dedicated increased source of funding is critical for our bus operators statewide. The metro area and the suburban areas are all bus providers who have growing needs for their service as well. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Dave Van Haddam. I'm with Transit for Livable and Haddam. I'm with Transit for Livable Communities and the chair of Transportation Forward. Transportation Forward is a statewide coalition of over 60 organizations representing community, labor, business, health, etc. Our coalition strongly supports long-term dedicated funding for all modes, roads and bridges, buses and trains, bicycling and walking. And we do support explicitly the increase in the gas tax, cab fees, metro sales tax increase that is in the Senate proposal, but we're also realists, and like you've heard over and over, we strongly urge you to find a compromise that gets the job done this year. I'm going to just touch on the transit bike walk components in the metro because I think you've heard a lot about the other pieces, and I'm going to emphasize three benefits of transit, kind of elaborating on some of what you heard, that transit benefits the economy, it addresses disparities and access to opportunities, and it has positive environmental impacts. So the Itasca Project, a business organization, not transit advocates, did a study of the build-out, a return on investment study of the build-out of metro transitways. They found $3 of direct economic benefit for every dollar invested. And if you look into the details, those benefits are reduced delays for everyone traveling in our metropolitan system. So transit benefits everyone by reducing those delays. Greater MFP site selectors, when they come here and think about bringing a large employer, they say, show us your transit map. Our peers, as you've heard, and I have a handout showing this, are well ahead of us. Dallas, Denver, Seattle all are have robust transit systems and are at a full set, completely to transit, and are building out those systems and leveraging federal dollars. But I also want you to think about access to opportunity. I'm guessing that just about everyone in this room has access to a car or owns a car. If you don't, the large share of jobs in the metro don't have convenient access by transit. So people are put in the position of either not having access to opportunity or buying a car when they're getting a low-income job and spending a huge amount on transportation. That's a lousy way to build wealth, and we can change that and address disparities. Finally, transit investment in transit, bicycling, and walking has very significant health and environmental benefits. People, when they're traveling on buses and trains on a per-passenger mile basis compared to drivers, consume about half the energy and a tiny fraction of the smog emissions. Bicycling is the fastest growing mode of transportation. That's what young people are choosing. It's the fastest growing mode of transportation, and it also happens to be the healthiest for individuals and the planet. Like all the other modes you've heard about, we know with pretty good detail what those bicycle and pedestrian needs are, and we need the funding to get those projects moved forward as well. So to conclude, our Coalition Transportation Board strongly supports the Senate position in increasing the metro sales tax as well as the other taxes for other modes. And I'll just note that sales tax aligns with the transit system, so generally those who benefit pay for it, has extremely low administrative costs, and is really how the other regions are sort of well out ahead of us. So again, I will thank all of you for your hard work, but we really think this combination of investment is a win-win-win on the economy, disparities in the environment, and we strongly urge you to find that compromise and make these critical and urgent investments. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of the 10 regional center, greater Minnesota counties, and 4 suburban counties here in the metro area. I want to start by thanking both sides for acknowledging the need out there. I do want to emphasize the need is great. We frequently hear the figure of $12 billion as being the 20-year shortfall. That only refers to state highways. The TFAC report acknowledges a need of over $45 billion over the next 20 years for all systems combined, transit, counties, cities, township, and the state system. So we as an organization support significant funding for transportation that is ongoing and sustainable. From our perspective, that does require dedication through the Highway User Distribution Fund to the extent we're talking about roads. Counties, in my estimate, have stepped up to the challenges. We are roundly criticized, but we feel an obligation to fund our road systems by increasing our property taxes every year, as well as exercising the other limited revenue authorities available to us through the wheelage tax and the sales tax. One of the needs that we would certainly like to see taken care of by any compromise that comes out of this committee is granting the same sales tax authority to every county in the state, not just the 82 that currently enjoy it. The 5 CTIP counties do not have the same access to the up to half-cent local option sales tax that every other county has. I also urge you to honor the agreement that was struck in 2008 that dedicated a portion of the lease motor vehicle sales tax to Greater Minnesota Transit and the suburban ring counties. This was part of a comprehensive compromise that addressed the various shortfalls that would have existed absent those revenues. And finally, I'll just want to remind the committee that one of the provisions that was enacted last year with regards to the CASA formula was that the 2008 split between the old apportionment sum formula and the new excess sum formula was frozen at 68% by the apportionment sum, 32 by my county supported that even though it was adverse to them. So we have made many compromises. We're making effort. Now is time for you to step up and make some effort on behalf of the state. With that, I'll conclude.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening. My name is Carolyn Jackson. I'm a lobbyist with the firm Flaherty & Hood, and I'm here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I want to thank all of you for all the work that you've done so far, and I appreciate that both the House and the Senate bill include provisions for corridors of commerce and for city streets. These are incredibly important programs for our communities. I just felt in part of the conversation, I want to remind people that this is also a matter of life and death for communities in greater Minnesota. In these highways that go from two lanes to four lanes to two lanes to four lanes, they're extremely dangerous. And every day that we hesitate or delay work on transportation is another day that people have to face these dangerous highways. And so thank you for the work. We do support a compromise of both general fund and new revenues, and we look forward to seeing some action in the committee, and we are very optimistic, and thank you for all the work that you've done.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening. Claire Roebling, representing Scott and Carver Counties, and I certainly appreciate the difficulty of your decisions. I'm just here on an issue that is especially critical to Carver and Scott Counties. As you know, in 2008, the transportation bill provided the option for the seven metro counties to join CTIP. And five counties did, but Carver and Scott, the two smallest and most rural counties, did not choose that option. Since that time, all the non-CTIP counties were given the option of imposing the half-cent sales tax. And this past year, in 2015, Scott County did impose a half-cent sales tax, and they put together a plan to indicate which projects they'd like to use it for, and they're mostly road projects and transit projects as well. And we would certainly appreciate continuing to have that ability without having it mandated upon us, as is indicated in the Senate bill. We feel it's important to have some control over our destiny, and I think all counties like the idea of having the choice, even the current CTIP counties, of having the choice. We all know that local government mandates are not popular. I'm sure many of you heard that many, many times, whether it's a school district or a city, county, or township. And so this is another one of those issues that we really hope that the local counties are given a choice in this. We certainly wouldn't want Scott County, for example, to have the 1% imposed on top of our 0.5%, and then we'd be the highest in the state. So, we're kind of caught, and we certainly hope you'll give us the consideration. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on this? Great. Seeing none. Senator Dibble, comment?
Well, get revved up here and give my 20-minute concluding speech. thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of like it. You know, we've been so nice to each other. We're a little mean to each other today. A little sparks flew, so that was good. We finally, I think, have gotten down to brass tacks and articulating some of our values and some of our perspectives and some of our critique of our respective bills. And I know that you've heard us, we've heard you. It's been a good, free and fair and open exchange. With that, I think we heard some good testimony as well from stakeholders and folks from the community. Prevailing themes, of course, are comprehensive and compromise and meaningful, etc. For folks who don't yet know, in the public or conference committee members, we do plan to call the next meeting for Friday in the morning sometime, not sure exactly when. got both finance and got to present real ID and state and local. So kind of work around that. But sometime in the morning, we'll figure it out tomorrow and post it.
Sure.
All right. Yeah. Morning-ish. So, well, whatever my boss over here says is when they're going to have it. at which point, and I think it's been announced, I think my majority leader indicated that, and we, you and I have talked about this, and that we intend to bring a proposal to the table on Friday that hopefully will be so amazingly brilliant and support all of our shared values and the views that were articulated at the table that you'll accept it and we'll be on our way.
There we
go. that's our plan for Friday.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'd just like to say I appreciate the first of all your attendance and our audience here. Thank you for staying with us. Thank you for being with us through this basically two-year march. I appreciate both the Senate and the House. I appreciate the passion that we, I guess, on these committees end up having, and it does get passionate at times. I can say about 2 years ago, I was asked, you know, what our plans were, where I thought we were going, and I said at that time I did not think this was a one-year plan. I didn't think we would be able to get to the point that we had to get to, which I believe was tonight. I didn't believe we were going to get there in a year, and this is where we are at, and we needed to do this one last time so that we can stay plainly to the state of Minnesota that we did listen to you. We certainly have heard you. We've heard from the lobbyists. We've heard from every corner of the state of Minnesota, I believe, and we've listened. I think it's very clear that we are now at the point where, I don't know how many times it is said that we need to compromise, but I am sure all of us understand that. So my commitment as I sit in this chair and represent the House, Senator Dibble, is that we will come on Friday with very real solutions and with compromise on our agenda. And so I look forward to that, and I look forward to starting on the path of bringing a transportation package to the state. With that, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.